Au moins, j'ai dit aux gens qui étaient en bas de leur dire qu'on a changé l'endroit de mon.
Oui, oui, mais je sais que les gens sont avec les
grands. Ah oui, d'accord. Oui, bah, on attend encore un petit peu.
Oui, je pense qu'il y a encore une heure.
Mais du coup, s'il y a besoin d'une souris, celle-là, elle est meilleure que le pavé.
A priori,
si jamais. Mais il y a les petites flèches aussi.
Si je fais passer, ça fait pareil.
Et pour les questions, si jamais on vous pose une question, vous pourriez la répéter pour les gens sur Zoom. Juste répéter la question. Parce que le micro est là et que là.
Ah oui, parce qu'il a dit que vous n'avez plus le micro.
Non, parce que je n'ai pas le truc qui connecte.
D'accord.
Et je vais aller vérifier juste comment le micro marche. Can people on Zoom hear us?
Yes.
Yes.
And you can see the slides, everyone.
Yes.
Good.
Ça démarre. Vous êtes dans les cartons, c'est pas normal. Vous n'êtes pas trop loin du travail. Luxe. Et les enfants.
Bon, mais c'est super. Mais du coup, tu as voulu prendre la presse et tu vas faire ça.
Thank you. So we can start this session of the Coffee Club. Today we have the pleasure to welcome Médéric Bocquian from Universitat Astrofa Gasta in Chile. And I'll leave the floor to you to do your presentation.
Thank you very much. So it's a great pleasure to be here today to tell you about a JWST, HST, VLTMU's Amateur Treasure Star Formation in nearby galaxies. This is a project that is led by a number of co-PIs, including Janice Lee, Eva Schinner, Kevin Sandstrom, Kirsten Larsen, Adam Leroy, and Dave Hilker. I'm Médéric Bocquian from Museum de Payasta. If you look at Chile, this is in the far north, near the big telescopes. So before talking about the project itself, I thought I would take a minute to look at what is the current state for the study of nearby galaxies with the current facilities. So for the past decades almost now, we have ALMA. ALMA is fantastic because that allows us to find molecular clouds that are going to feed star formation. With JWST, we can see the earliest phases of star formation. With MUSE, we can see those clouds being disrupted, and with HST, we can see the young stellar populations. So that means with this combination, we have access to the entire biome cycle at a very resolved scale in nearby galaxies. And really, the big game changer this year is JWST. Until then, we only had SPITZER. The resolution of SPITZER is a lot worse. So if we wanted to do this sort of study in galaxies, we were essentially limited to the local group. So something like M33, it looks great with SPITZER, but we have very few galaxies. This is a very limited environment. So with JWST, we can do the same kind of thing, but not at, I don't remember exactly the distance of M33, it's like 800 kiloparsec, but this time we can do that at 16 megaparsec, okay? So that allows us to dissect quanta of star formation NISM to do physics at high angular resolution in nearby galaxies. And this is what FANGS is about. So FANGS is initially an ALMA survey, CO221, of nearby galaxies. So most of them are in the south, obviously, because we need to be able to see them with ALMA. They sample reasonably well the Stefan versus stellar mass plane. You see here every blue point is a Fangs galaxy. So there are 90 Fangs galaxy here, quite nearby. Most of them are closer than 17 parsec. And they are well, kind of like a normal galaxy, reasonably neutral rich. So nothing too extreme. Now, Fangs was really the beginning. There have been a number of complementary surveys. The first of them that was led by Janice Lee is the HST survey. We couldn't observe 90 of them. It would have taken too long. We observed 38 of those galaxies. It's already a very good sample. But we didn't stop there. Then we had a new survey led by Eric M. Salem, where we selected half the sample, 19 galaxies. Now the ones you can see on the right, and with generosity, we are observing these very same galaxies. So that means for these galaxies, we have ALMA, MUSE, HST. So here you have the kind of like colors, GRNI composite. In red, you have the H-alpha, so you see we have quite a bit of star formation all over the place. And in blue, you have the Miri field of view with generosity. So to guide the eye, the little little ticks here indicate 1 kiloparsec. So we still have quite a good extent on those galaxies, even though we kind of miss like very outer regions because, well, too expensive. Anyway, what are we going to do with JGC? What we are doing, in fact, is that we are observing those galaxies in 8 bands with MIRI and MIRCam. So we have the F200W, F300W, and F360W filters. That provides us a low obscuration view of the photospheric emission of stars. We have the F55M, 770W, and 1130W. That probes the pH emission, and that is sensitive, I will come back to that later, to the size and the charge of the pH. We have F1000W and 2100W, so 10 and 21 microns. There we are sensitive to the continuum dust emission. And bonus for really dusty regions, at the macron, we are sensitive to the silicate decay absorption feature. In terms of sensitivity, we get a CNR2 noise better than 10 for 2,000 solar mass clusters for an AV of 10 magnitudes. so quite dusty objects. And obviously, it gets better, for instance, at 2 micron if the AV is lower than that. In terms of diffuse emission, the idea is that kind of like detect M33 equivalent diffuse emissions. So we have a CNR2 noise of 3 at 0.3 megadensity per steroid. So something I would really like to emphasize is the insane resolution we are getting. So if you take a galaxy that is at 16 megaparsec, considering that the PSF of JWST is 0.066 arcsecond, that gives us 5 parsec. Even if you go all the way to 21 micron, that's 0.67 arcsecond, so that's 52 parsec. So I don't know about you, but for someone like me who started this career working on nearby galaxies and resolution is at least hundreds of parsecs, if not kiloparsecs, this is just mind-blowing. You will see some images later in something I couldn't even like dream of. It's just incredible. So what are we going to do with all that? First, we are going to provide some science products. Why? Because this is a treasury program. It's not just for us, it's for the entire community. So we are going to provide cross-observatory science really images, really for you, not just for us. We are going to provide a complete JWST plus HST census of star clusters. For instance, if you want to look at the eventual sequence of clusters from embedded clusters, very dusty to ancient clusters. We are going to combine JWST ALMA and MUSE, clouds and H2 regions, to, for instance, if you want to look at formation and destruction timescales. We are also going to provide maps of pH emission and small band properties. That are matched with ISM state. For instance, we have metallicity. We have a number of information that we get from other observatories. For instance, you could look at feedback. But overall, we are going to combine all those data, imaging and spectroscopy, and link everything together. So we have an example here of H2 regions, GMCs, and for instance, here is a MUSE spectrum. Okay, so we have a number of science goals. This is not quite limited to that, but just a few examples. For instance, we are really interested in cluster formation and disruption. So we would like to look at the cluster formation efficiency, the famous gamma, you may have heard of it. So we looked at the cluster mass function, for instance, using ALMA data. But do we get the same thing with JWST or not? So that is going to be really interesting. And the great thing with JWST is that for now, we just had HST data. So getting ages from HST is really difficult because you have degeneracy between the age and the attenuation, essentially. So JWST, because it's very sensitive to dust, is going to help us basically anchor the age of those very young clusters. So we know if they are 1 million years old or 5 million years old. All right. So something else we'd like to do, for instance, is to understand why some molecular clads are seemingly not forming stars. So the question is it due simply to delay, or is it due that there is some process that is actually preventing those clads from forming stars? So we expect that that can happen like a bit randomly across the galaxy. But if you look, for instance, at the NGC 4303 or 4535, we see that there are those long filaments. Here, blue is CO and red is H alpha. So we have those long blue filaments here and here, for instance, like everywhere I put an arrow, that that is not forming stars apparently, at least from the point of view of H alpha. You have other filaments that have H alpha. So why these do not have H alpha? Is that they are not forming stars? Or is it maybe that there is star formation going on, but it's too early to see it in H alpha? And we will be able to tell that with JWST. So that brings us to the question of how long star formation remains embedded. There have been a lot of work by the team of Derek Rison. So here is an example from Jeong Kim. And what she did here basically was to take very nearby galaxies and putting apertures either on CO peaks or on well, here's 24 micron to trace star formation and see how that the ratio basically evolves as a function of resolution. And that tells you basically with a bit of theory, with a lot of theory, Derek has written huge papers on that, how long the embedded star formation phase lasts. And you can see those galaxies are all like very close stuff, like LMC M31, M33, M51, NGC 300. And the really blocking point is that we need resolution for that. And that's very hard to do beyond the local group until, well, essentially until now. So the big thing with JWST is that this kind of study can be done, but this time on a much broader, much more diverse sample of galaxies. And we are not bound to do closest galaxies. All right, so as I said, we are interested in embedded star formation. So how do we actually trace star formation from JWST? Well, we have a little bit of a problem, is that when you look at star formation rate estimators, you realize on resolved galaxies that is going to depend on the environment and the scale you are looking at things. So with JWST, in combination with all the other data set that we are going to be able to put a constraint and better understand this dependence. Once it's understood, we can give much more reliable estimates of the star formation rate. And that is that has a direct impact on the models. You know, if we get the star formation wrong, then, well, our constraints wouldn't be all quite right. Another thing. So if you look at very nearby galaxies here, I took a figure from Johnny Chastanet, who looked at dust in the imaginary clouds, you quickly realize that the dust properties can vary a lot on very small scales. And if you look at the associated parameters such as radiation field, density, ISM phase, etc., you can find variations of the factor like 1,000 on 10 to 100 parsec scale. So with JWST, we are going to be able to do this sort of study, but not just in imaginary clouds, in a number of galaxies that differ quite a bit from the specific properties of the clouds. And that will be extremely informative on the formation and destruction of dust in general, which is a very important question. For star formation, how to trace star formation, really. So, I think I've teased you enough now, so I thought I would show you the images in the order we received them. So the first one we got is NGC 7496. This is a beautiful image made by Judy Schmidt. She's amazing at processing this kind of data and make them gorgeous. So here, this is a combination of HST and JBST. With HST, we see like the young stellar clusters here in blue. With JBST, we can see a bit of the dust. Now, what if we get a pure JBST view? This is what we would get. And this is simply amazing. Just in one image, we can see there's so much physics going on. We can see very warm dust here in star forming regions. We can see in the center that is an AGN. We can see this parallelogram here, like a huge, interesting star forming region that has this weird shape here. You can see some kind of like spurs going out of the arms. So really something amazing. And almost right away, like a few days later.
What is the size of this image?
The size of the image? It's a good question. That must be 2 mirifield of views, I think. So then we got IC5332. Very different galaxy. We see there is dust a bit all over the place. Quite nice, but that's not my favorite. So this one is the lowest metallicity galaxy in the sample. We can tell in some way there is not so much diffuse emission, just a little bit. But we see quite clearly all the dense gas clouds.
What's the filter combination that you use?
Oh, that is a complicated combination. So Jelly like made some. No, it's not like red, green, blue. So I think like one channel is actually orange, and she combined different filters. It's kind of like, you know, artistic magic. So this is not just one, just 3 filters here. That's the combination of various filters. It makes the images beautiful. If I try to do something like that, I would never succeed. That is quite a bit of work she probably spent around like a day or two making this kind
of thing. But she combined Kevin up to NIRI or just
So this one is just NIRI because the near-cam observations failed. So this will be repeated, but it's going to take a while. So this one is just it's just NIRI.
Sorry, Derek. Is it a cutout or do you have a full image? Well, a larger.
Well, it's okay. I mean, I slightly cut to fit the aspect ratio of the.
Is it really to have some black part?
But it doesn't go. I mean, maybe it goes like down here and a bit over there. But that's pretty much all we have. We don't have sky, which is a problem because you may have heard of JBST walls with calibration. Makes things a little complicated. But yeah, that's basically all of it. Or close to it. So here is the fan's favorite, or at least it's my favorite. It's NGC 628. Absolutely beautiful spiral. We can see like kind of like grand design. And you see bubbles everywhere. I will come back to that. It's really fantastic. There is a nuclear cluster. And it's just like mind blowing when you look at that. So much detail. And the last one we got, so for now we only have 4 out of 19. Is NGC 1365. That is a very strong AGN in the center. You can see here, you can distinguish actually the JBST PSF. So a bit too much. We don't quite like seeing PSFs, but point source, very, very bright. You can see there is a lot of diffuse emission. Like it's not very dense, but like very, very diffuse, very extended. If you go a bit further out, you see gold star from emissions here. So again, it's something that is absolutely beautiful. So I guess I can admit that we may have spent a little bit too much time in various telecoms just, you know, looking at the images, and we're like, wow, it's just absolutely fantastic to look at that. But after a while, you know, we went to our senses like, hey, but you know, we worked so hard to get those data, it's to do science. So let's get going. So what are we working on? So we are working on bubbles. So this is work led by Elizabeth Watkins. So what she's doing here is that she's taking NGC 628 and she's trying to measure bubbles at 7.7 microns. So at this wavelengths, you see pH emission. So here's an example. Then she made various combinations with different bands here. It's 7.7 in red, you have HR-fly in green, and you have HST in blue at 438 nanometers. And what you got is 1,695 bubbles. And in fact, she could have kept going. There would have been more and more and more bubbles, yeah?
How do you define bubbles?
How do I define bubbles? Well, you have your image, you have like kind of like a bubble. What is part of a bubble? No, like an arc, essentially. And then basically what she did is she used ES9 and like drew like on what looked like arcs.
By hand? Bubbles.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so yeah, this it's not like an unphysic algorithm. So she spent like a week looking at those various images. It's like a huge work. And she could have kept going. So she stopped there because you know after a week it gets like a little exhausting. And she thought, okay, like hang on, now is enough. Let's try to see what I get from that. And so she built the size distribution of those bubbles. And it follows a power index of -2.1. Well, this is interesting. But then when you look at Flurry, apparently Flurry says it should be -2.7. So, well, an idea could be maybe that there are some bubbles merging and this is changing the stop of the distribution.
Which theory?
Yeah. What do you mean? Which theory?
Would it say, when say theory says that to be -2.7?
Well, you take.
Would it mean by theory?
Which theory? Well, I'm not sure I do the detail of the bubble dynamics in galaxies. But so you take, for instance,
from dynamics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can take simulations and you see, for instance, how the index changes and this kind of thing.
Based on numerical simulations of galaxy formation.
You can. Well, yeah, I mean, if you have like high enough resolution, you can do that. There might also be like purely theoretical work, just like big equations. I'm not a theoretician, so I won't venture too much into this.
In which band is it supposed to be -2.7?
I don't think it depends on the band, because the bubble is the same in any wavelength.
We should know
that
which kind of simulation it's used. Because the theory says, okay, but there's a simulation behind it.
It depends
on the kind of simulation, I guess. No?
Well, okay, I mean, that way, yeah, you need to have like enough resolution, this kind of thing. And you are going to have some effects if you don't have enough resolution for sure, because at least you are going to lose the smaller ones.
Eric, what are those bubbles? I'm confused. Is it a place where you don't have pH regions?
Yeah. So
you have a lack of pH?
Yeah.
But within the arms, not between the arms.
So
clearly you can have plenty of
anywhere. So here. So for instance, you take this image. Okay, here is a bubble. Here is another bubble. Here is another bubble. Etc. Et
okay,
so,
but this is like one bubble.
Huh?
This is one bubble or it's
could be, yeah, could be. Well I'm going to show you right after. So here is a big bubble. You have bubbles everywhere and they are different sizes. And you have bubbles within bubbles. So if you look closely, you can find like a big bubble, and in that bubble you can find like smaller bubbles.
So you define bubble by threshold in luminosity.
So yes, you have to special something.
No gas.
Your intensity.
No, mostly no dust. So there is
no dust. So it does not mean no stars.
Doesn't mean no star.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's I mean, clear. One way to form those bubbles is that you have like a strong observed star formation in the center, then you have some feedback that pushes gas out, and then you have like this concentration of dust. We're also looking at the presence of like maybe ionized gas in the center, and there can be a little bit of something, and you know the emission goes to the square of the density. So this is very faint, the density is quite low, but we may still have a little bit of gas in the center. So it's not completely devoid, but there is a very low density, and in terms of dust, well, I mean, you can see here that dust is gone, essentially. It has been pushed.
Okay.
Yeah, or even more than one, probably, yeah, for this kind of bubble. Okay, so Anyway, so there is a difference between what she found and what Marie in general says. Now there was a question, okay, she found maybe it's just the way I did things, maybe like I am biased. So someone else in the team also did the exact same thing.
We have one last question. Why not bubbles in front of bubbles?
Bubbles in front of bubbles?
Yes, it said it that there are small bubbles within the bubble.
You can see, for instance, here or on the edge of bubbles.
Like, for instance, in the center, I don't understand. There is one that's clearly. Well, clearly, don't see any.
Yeah, it's very preliminary.
Yes, so that's
here. They try to do. You know,
where? Yeah, but for instance, this one.
The one in the center.
Yeah.
I don't understand how it's.
There's no dust. It means that.
No, there is an intensity.
That's the same. That's the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's clear.
Yeah. Here you just have like short wavelength emission. Actually, we have a little bit of MIRI emission. I'm not going to show that. But that's mostly like the blue point here. Obviously, a big cluster that is 10^6 solar masses, and there is a tiny bit of MIRI emission. Is I assume this is just dust being produced by HEB. It's probably not in the solar dust.
So can I just comment? So Matt Pieri here on Zoom. Two things. Firstly, technical. Your video is showing something different from the slides that are shared on Zoom for some reason. I don't know if there's a delay, but if it is, it's really long. We see something different shared than you're showing on your camera. But we can just look at your camera. Yeah, something weird's happening there. Oh, right. Yeah, that may have fixed it. So I was asking if it's bubbles in front of bubbles. I was just curious if there's some projection.
Well, I don't think here there is a huge projection because the galaxy is almost face-on, right? And the thickness of the gas disk is not all that much.
It has to be very small bubbles for that to even be possible.
Yeah, most of the bubbles. Because if it gets big enough, well, you know, it just like pierces through the gas layer and through the IGM. So and at this point, like the dynamics completely changes, of course, because it's much easier to expand vertically. But for small bubbles, yeah, I can imagine that there is a kind of like a 3D structure.
So you put the work of Watkins.
So
just to remind us about the literature. So what's the aim? I don't know about what has been done in the nearby galaxies. What is the aim to measure the number and the size of the bubbles? What will it tell us about the formation of the formation of the galaxy.
So for that, we need to think of the origin of the bubbles.
Yes.
Right. This is feedback. So looking at the distribution,
the
size.
Okay. So feedback. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. It's clear.
Can I have just a quick question on that? Just not to disturb later. So it's super nice, but I guess doing it by hand,
it's
exhausting. But have you thought? I was just interested. Do you have in mind some possible algorithms that already exist that you could use for this kind of work? I'm not necessarily developing the entire machinery
now,
but I think there are things on the market that can be used.
So I think the idea was to try not to be too tied to a specific method. And those are very early data. So Elizabeth said, okay, I'm just going to do that myself. One of the ideas, a bit longer term, is once we have more data, is to have this go through something like Galaxy Zoo. And then we can go like much further than 1.25. Galaxy Zoo.
Ah, yeah, but you were speaking about it's different, something automatic. So I think it's great to do it by hand because you know what you're doing. It's like a control sample. But then after you pass it automatic machinery or whatever, there are tools to identify. And I think it's very also dependent on the which kind of filter you use.
Sure.
I think it would be great.
What has been done is to measure for H alpha image, at least to measure the H alpha yes, props, and then the bubble are something which is in between.
Like you mean with some algorithm?
Yeah, yes, with some algorithm.
That would be the next stage.
Yeah, yeah, there is something just to find the not the bubble, but the bubble will be the difference between the
So there will be a lot more work on that. I guess we could also like train machine learning algorithms for like identifying this kind of thing. I guess it would work fairly well.
How do you measure the radius of elliptical bubble?
What do you mean?
What? Yeah, the average radius on the x-axis.
But it's an average. It's an average.
It's just the average radius.
It's depending on the size of your projection of your bubble. A round bubble or an elliptical bubble.
But this is the average. The average radius of your.
They just arrived. The pictures.
Well, I mean, look at the size of the beans. It's not going to have a huge effect.
The sample is only facing galaxy or very small.
Not all that well. I can show you that.
It was specifically designed for that.
So they're not all super facing, but they are. I mean, when you look at them, they are facing enough that we shouldn't worry too much in most cases about inclination effects. This one, like maybe a bit more inclined. But we don't have like H1 galaxies. So the gradient for FANGs is that the inclination is at most 70 degrees, but I mean, we don't think we have like 70 degrees for example. I didn't check the inclination for the JWST subsample, but you can see here it's quite facing.
And there is no interest to have some H1?
No, because
of course you will have a lot of detail depth, but at least at least to start to see the impact on the height of the how was the feedback constraint because you're interested by feedback.
Yeah, but
that's nice on Facebook, but can you see anything non-trivial on the
idea of FANGs is to see what's going on in galaxies. Yeah. So I agree it would be interesting to see what happens for John galaxies. I mean it has been done like a number of times with news, etc., to try to look at the vertical structure. But here, that's not quite the aim. I'm sure like some people in the FANGs team are going to have like proposals for H1 galaxies. But for what we are doing, no, that wouldn't have meshed well with the general science goals of FANGs. But I mean, it's a very interesting thing to do. It's just not the aim of the project.
Okay, where was I?
So I was here. So I was saying, like, second person did that, Ken Mahaney, a student at the University of Wyoming. And result is that she also found minus 2.1. So it was quite reassuring. Two people in the team did the exact same thing independently and found the same result. So there'll be a lot more to understand, you know, the origin of this index. Now, bubbles are creating a lot of interest. So Ashley Barnes took a couple of very interesting bubbles. So he took this bubble here, huge, huge bubble. And you can see that small bubbles inside this bubble. And oops.
Sorry, because the people on Zoom couldn't see the.
Yeah, Zoom does that sometimes.
Yeah.
So basically what it is that he selected a couple of those bubbles and looked at them in a multiple wavelength fashion. So he used MUSE, ALMA, ASTROSAT, HST, SPEEDZER, there was like everything possible to try to understand what's going on. So of course we don't have the standardization everywhere. So if you look at this big bubble, you know, in those instruments, here's what you see. So you will have like H1 with VLA, of course, resolution is not as good. And what we did was, for instance, to look at the location of clusters and the age. So with HSC, we measured the age, And what basically found is that in the bubble, you have no young cluster. They're all at least like 10 million years old. Whereas in the shell, you have young clusters, okay? And well, if you go further out, there are still like clusters of basically all ages. But this is quite interesting that like in the bubble, basically you had an episode of star formation, and that probably what created the bubble, pushed the gas out, and well, of course, we stopped the star formation because then there was no gas left. So there is quite a bit of work trying to understand basically what's going on, and then when you look at the shell here, okay, is it that we are having like triggered star formation, or is it just that you know there is star formation because of this gas? Not quite the same thing. So this is the sort of thing that that we are going to look at over the coming months and years.
Can it trigger the star formation because there is this shell? Can it trigger the star formation with a different density threshold than what you expect usually?
That's one of the questions we would love to answer. I mean, when you look at that, say, oh yeah, it's real star formation, but maybe not. Maybe simply that, you know, we are forming stars, you know, the usual way, but, you know, we have like more gas, so we are simply forming stars, and that's it. Could be that. Well, it's a little early to answer, but this is the sort of thing, yeah, we are very interested to understand. So I mentioned earlier the question of embedded star formation. So Jae Yong Kim is here again, but this time what she did was to take NGC 628, and she did the same thing, but now much more distant galaxy, not in the local group. And what she found is that half of the embedded star formation phase is not visible in H alpha. So basically here. You see the time scales where we saw CO, zero, so like CO disappears. And we see 24 micron emission before CO disappears and after CO disappears, and same for H alpha. So we first see 24 micron, then we see H alpha. But that means that we can have, for instance, H alpha, sorry, we can have 24 micron without H alpha. So it comes back to what I was saying earlier, for instance, are these CO clouds star forming or not? Even though we don't see any H alpha, like nothing escapes, maybe that we can get that with infrared emission.
Sorry.
Sure.
We have a non-line
question. Yeah. Can you ask the question on your microphone, please?
I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, my question is first, is this finished? I was not sure that the presentation was finished.
No, sorry, I thought you had
the question
now.
All right.
Perhaps it could be better to wait at the end of the presentation to ask questions.
Okay. Well, I don't have 20 more slides, so let's get going. So for those of you who are very much into theory, don't ask me too much detail because I'm not sure I fully understand everything. But this is work that is being led by Sharon Mind from the University of Ghent. So basically, what she's doing here is that she's looking at a couple of galaxies, NGC 628 and IC 5232, and she's looking at a quasi-regular web of filaments, void, and shells. So basically, she looked at this kind of like spurs, I don't know how to call that, that go out from the spiral arms. So she looked at those filaments, and she compared that to the tubular G-strengths that she measured from ALMA, and what she told me is that it's the same, so it is good. I'm not sure why it's good, but apparently it's very good. So this is the kind of thing that that we can do. It's much more oriented towards theory and the dynamics of those galaxies. As I mentioned, I'm not a specialist of that. Then a work by Adam Leroy. So what he has been doing is to try to understand the relation between CO and dust emission. So he found that both CO and HR flux correlate well with the medium for emission, which is kind of reassuring. There's always like a bit devolving in the details. So he's looking at this kind of thing to better understand how it correlates at different wavelengths, because we're not tracing exactly the same kind of dust depending on the wavelengths. So he's having a very detailed look at that. Then there is Jimena Rodriguez, who is interested in finding an embedded cluster. So those clusters that are so dusty, we barely see them or not at all in HST bands. So what she did first is to look at some images and find some clusters that we could only see in JWST. After she put them on a must be color magnitude diagram. So the color here is 300m minus 335m. So 300m probes the stellar continuum, 335m probes the 3.3 micron pH line. So basically, you see here that the color is going to tell you how strong the dust emission is going to be compared to the continuum. And here, this is the mode of the strength of the line emission. So she found the ones with the stars and then defined a region and then took all the clusters in this region and then classified them as embedded, intermediate, and visible. And you can see that there is indeed a lot of embedded clusters, but the ones in red. The ones that are quite visible in HST, they're in green. So we seem to understand exactly why we have some that are like really close, you know, almost the same colors. It's going to be interesting, maybe some effect of the geometry. So now she's looking at those clusters, trying to understand what are they properties, what are the ages, etc. So this is just like in one galaxy, this is 7.96. Then with Dion Dale, we have been looking at pH properties versus cluster age. You know, if you have a cluster, it's got to be a star formation, you can think it can affect the dust properties. So we are using three galaxies. As I mentioned, we don't have near-term galaxy observations for one galaxy. So of course, it's dropped. And what we are looking here, basically, it's kind of like color plots. You can see basically we do ratios of pH line, 335 to 11.3, and then 335 to 7.7. We are comparing that to the latest models of drain and collaborators. And what is nice here is that, as I mentioned earlier, the pH bands that we have can constrain the ionization fraction and can constrain the size of the pH. And this is what we are seeing here. In cyan here, those are the small pH, large pH are in kind of like magenta. And then you have the ionization fraction. So to the left, those are the ionized pH, to the right, those are the neutral pH. And we see a few things. We see that for most cases, the large ionized models are favored. It's quite interesting. And there's a fly that's assaulting me. Then there is a gradient where you see basically right here, those are the older clusters, and you can see like a gradient color. Green is between 10 and 100 million years, and blue is less than 10 million years. So it's quite scattered, but there is some gradient in the physical properties depending on the age of the clusters. And again, this is something that is quite natural in some way. Because certainly the stellar radiation is going to affect those pH. And it must be my last slide. Karen Sandstrom has been working hard to extract the 3.3 micron pH line. So you would think, oh, well, it shouldn't be too complicated. I mean, after all, we have three bands here, 3 micron, 335, and 3.6. Well, here is a zoom on a small region. And you can see that 335, well, this is where we are more sensitive to pH emission because this is where we have the line. We indeed have quite a bit of diffuse emission, but we also have a lot of stars. And at 360, this is where we would think we only have stars, but in reality, we see quite a bit of diffuse emission. So when you see diffuse emission in a band where you should only see stars, it's kind of like, oof, warning. If you look in detail at the shape of the filter, we may be getting like the tail end of the 3.3 micron line. And also there are some features like a 3.4 micron that we were not quite aware. but these, they were always ignored in extragalactic studies until quite recently. So that may pollute a little bit this line. So she has been working hard on devising a method to work around those problems and to extract the 3.3 micron pH line as reliably as possible. And this is quite quite critical, because this line is is accessible over a broad range of redshifts. Okay, and that can be used for instance to trace star formation. And this is dust that we have, right? And getting dust at 3.3 micron, you know, it's not all that easy. You need to go to longer wavelengths, but then you lose in terms of resolution, you lose in terms of sensitivity, for instance, if you need to go to MIRI. So that line is actually very important for so many things. And we need to find good ways to actually extract this line to have a reliable flux to measure, for instance, star formation rate. And yeah, so that was my last slide. So this is just a small subsample of what we are working on. There are 21 letters in preparation that are going to be submitted basically by the end of next week to APJAL for a focus issue. So I think you should start seeing the first papers on AstroPH within a few weeks. And as I said, there will be a lot more on that.
Sorry, again.
Thank you for your attention.
Sorry.
Again, if we still have a little bit of time to additional questions, there you go.
I have a very quick question from the beginning of the selection of the sample. So I understood these 19 galaxies, so targeted with GWs. The fact you said, oh, okay, look, there is an AGN. So I don't know which kind of the type of the AGN, but when you've selected it, you knew that there was an AGN?
Yep.
Yes, okay. And
yeah, so
okay, so there is not like a discovery of an AGN, okay.
No, so for instance, the idea, so that one is pretty strong. I mean, and so you have the AGM, you have like nice ring of star formation, so it's like quite complex region, and you can see like the diffusion spikes like all over the place. And the hope was that maybe we could see like some feedback features in those bands. In the end, we're not quite seeing them. But that was quite uncertain, but we are.
So my corrected question is, the decorrelation between the CO and the star formation, is it linked to the presence of not of an AGN, and is there a correlation with radius or not?
So you mean, when did I do that? Not it was before. You mean this one?
For instance.
No, I don't think there's anything to do with the AGN, because if there is an AGN in those galaxies, I don't remember, because you see this is kind of like all over the place in the galaxy. So okay, this one is reasonably close to the center, but like, see this part is like a lot of blue.
So you don't see any correlation with the fact that it's far away or not from the nucleus?
No, I don't think there is any strong train. Yeah, this is, we find those filaments a bit all over the place.
So is it connected to the dark scale?
There was a question before you.
I have also a question related to the sample. So those 19 galaxies that were selected, among them there is a couple of very nice either grand design bars or nuclear bars. And I was wondering whether that's sort of coincidence or you had in mind, or there is an ongoing project looking at the star effect bars on the star formation, this kind of thing. But they're still highly debated, and I think it would be really nice for this resolution.
So there is work on that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting aspects we want to look at.
With really the focus of like a physics of the bar dynamics and everything impacting the star formation.
Yeah, and the great thing is that you know we have pretty much everything. With ALMA, we have the dynamics. Also with MUSE, we have the ASO, like star formation, HST. We have stars that are like outside of the dwarf cloud. So this is not just JWST. If we just had JWST data, what you could do would be a lot more limited.
Mm-hmm.
But the key things that made JWST data and a lot of absolutely amazing data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. Wanted to ask something? Yeah.
Yeah, about the fact that you detect some CO and not in H-alpha, that he has a... is there any physical mechanics that can explain this?
Well,
because I think some people were talking about dark CO at a redshift where you can see CO but not no sign of star formation.
No, but
is it something different than what you are talking here?
No, but the dark CO would be different. It's more like molecular gas that you cannot see, no?
Yeah, maybe it
doesn't meet in CO, at least not as much as it should for its mass. Well, here we are very interested to understand. It could be that simply that the time scales for those stars are such that we are not seeing star formation right away. It takes like some millions of years. But it could be that, for instance, the gas clouds are kept, you know, a bit too warm to be able to form stars. Then we need to understand how, and there may be like some dynamical reasons. But first, we need to see whether we have star formation from JWST. So if we have star formation, well, we know it's forming stars. And so the question is, it's not the same. If it's not forming stars, then we can try to understand why it's not forming stars. But yeah, the first thing is like, okay, is it forming stars to begin with?
Next up, we have an online question. So, no, we can't hear. Okay. Can you ask the question, please?
Yes. So thank you very much for this very nice presentation. I'm really happy to see that H2 regions are coming back in front of the scene. So I was wondering, when you said that there is this bubble into bubbles, I think that we see this very clearly in the galaxy as soon as you have this impact of H2 region, and then you form a collected layer of dense material, then you will form new stars, including massive stars. So you will have a new bubble inside. And this is something very common that we observe in the galactic plane, for example. So I was wondering if you are considering doing comparisons with what we know in the galaxy. So this is my first question. And the second question was, what kind of models do you use to do the physics associated with feedback of H2 region? Thank you.
Okay. So yes, certainly at some point we are going to do some, I don't know if you the slides back. We are going to do a comparison with the Milky Way. For now, this is just really just the beginning. it's after. Oh, okay. For instance, here, even here, it's even better. So we are going to compare with the Milky Way at some point. So now it's really just the very, very beginning. So what we decided is that we are not going to play too much with any models for now, because we are just, you know, like a few weeks to prepare the papers, and if we want to do models, then we need essentially months to run them and then, you know, make sure that our results are okay. So it's more of like empirical first approach, and we are going to include models like in the second step. That is going to start essentially at the end of next week, once the papers, first batch of papers is submitted. Then we are going to move to more advanced modeling or modeling at all, which we have not done now, and in some purposes. We wanted to stay reasonably observational and take data that were, for the most part, already computed. For instance, this one, like the cluster associations, like all these, actually is result from work with HST. This is not something new that was done for this paper. We are just reusing all the great thanks data that we have been working on for the past few years to get this first batch of papers out, while hopefully saying interesting things for us and for the community. And models will come in a second step.
Thank you.
Does anyone else have a question, either online or here? No. So thank you, Derek, for this nice presentation. I think we're on time. Let's thank the speaker again.
I can advertise next week Cafe Club, which will be a PhD student from the Max Planck in Garting. The name is Puvunavine Uteria, he'll talk about something recent highlights from MBA on gravitational wave sources in quadruple star systems.
Wow.